Coming to you direct from the nerve center of the galaxy's greatest comic. This is the 2000 AD Thrillcast.
Borag Thunderflix and welcome to the latest episode of the 2000 AD Thrillcast Lockdown Tapes. And I am your host, as always, Monchar. I hope you are keeping well. On this episode, we have a nice long chat with an artist who's a particular favourite of mine from the 1990s. And that's Simon Jacob, who was the artist on Armageddon and Dead Meat, as well as Tales from the Doghouse, bit of a Harlem Heroes reboot, Robo Hunter, Judge Dredd. So it's fantastic to be able to sit down with him and just, find out what he's been up to. He's been absent from 2000 AD for quite some time. So, fascinating chat with him. Thanks for all the feedback we've been getting on the Thrillcast over the last few weeks. If you've not checked out the 2000 AD audiobooks from Penguin Random House, then do head along to Audible, where other services are available, where you can buy those and immerse yourself in the world of Judge Dredd, Slaying the Horn God, Halo Jones, and Brink. And again, the feedback on those has been fantastic, so thank you so much for supporting that. Without much further ado, we're going to crack on with a chat with Simon Jacob, artist on Armageddon and Dead Meat. There is, I'll be honest with you, a dearth of information about Simon Jacob on the internet. So,
yes, I know.
This will mostly be me poking you
to
talk about stuff.
Yes, of course.
But give us a rundown of your background, because you're West Country, is that right?
No, I was born in the South. Actually, certainly at the time of getting into comics, I was living in the Midlands, in Burton-on-Trent, but moved to the West Country probably 10 years ago or so. So I'm familiar with Colville, for example. It's one of the places that we used to frequent, because at the same time I was always playing in bands and things like that. So from the late 70s through the 80s, I was gigging around the Midlands, miners clubs, things like that, up in Nottinghamshire and Colville and all around those places. So that was where I grew up. We moved from down south as a family when I was about five or six, and moved into a village in the Midlands, which is where I grew up, and stayed there until I left to come down here 10 years ago. So I didn't move around very much. I was pretty stationary.
Tell me a bit about your family background. Is art something that's in your family?
No, I think it's safe to say my grandfather was a painter, but I think he also had no hair. So we've got that much in common. Bald as a coot at 27 he was, so and quite a good watercolourist, but that's about it. I've got two older brothers, all of whom are into sort of music in one form or another. Most of us are kind of guitar players and things, but the art and illustration side seemed to be just me. And from quite early on, sort of obsessed with writing stories and illustrating stories. And, just that was always my go-to hobby as a kid, from as early as I can remember, really. You know, I was writing stories probably when I was 7 or 8, something like that, and drew to illustrate the stories, and then probably ended up spending more time drawing the stories. But in terms of the family, definitely not. It was just came from somewhere else. I've no idea.
And I realized. This morning I was interviewing Kevin O'Neill. We were chatting about being working class and how his family weren't particularly artistic. Is that your kind of background? Not to reduce everything down to class stereotypes, but yourself as working class?
I think at that time, I don't know how you would call it. My dad was full time Navy. He came out of the Royal Navy. I think in the probably around the same time we moved north. So we'd always been a Navy family, and I don't know where that sits us, whether that puts you into working class or whatever it does. I'd never really thought about it, to be honest with you. At that time, my mother was a housewife. She raised the kids because hard to imagine, but in those days, he would go away to sea for 3 years at a time, you know, and she was at home with three boys, which I think itself was quite a challenge. And then he'd come home from wherever he'd been, and it was like meeting a stranger, you know, it was somebody walking through the door who you haven't seen literally for 3 years. It's hard to imagine now. And as he came out of the Navy, he did what a lot of Royal Navy guys did, which was go and work for Rolls-Royce on the submarine program. So in Derby at the time, they were building the reactors. Rolls-Royce were building the reactors for the submarines, which were based, I think, up at Dounreay.
Yeah.
So that's why we moved up. And I suppose it was a working class household with middle class aspirations. You know, we were in a village out in the country. So my memory of growing up was just fantastic. You know, it was all out in the fields and just running wild, really, pretty much. And nothing, in retrospect, we clearly didn't have a lot of money, because when you look at how we live now and how we lived then, it was very, very modest. You know, it's a small house and presumably modest income. My mum eventually retrained as a teacher, and that changed everything a little bit as I was growing up. But yeah, pretty standard, not extravagant. Probably you would describe it as working class, I guess. And pretty quiet life, really.
Yeah. But how did art, and I'm thinking about particularly about comics, fit into your personality? Were you quiet? Was this an escape?
Definitely not quiet, I don't think. Notoriously talkative, silly,
right?
Very silly sense of humour, which got pointed out to me on more than one occasion, and would talk endlessly. I'll talk ad infinitum. If it's about me in particular, I'll talk indefinitely, you know. So it wasn't a retreat, but it was definitely an urge, I think. To begin with, it was like trying to draw. As a kid, I used to buy the collections of Peanuts books, you know, the Charles Schulz stuff. I loved them. I just absolutely loved that 3-4 panel moments that he would capture. And the sort of like little philosophical twists in there, it just absolutely appealed to me. So the first cartoons I started drawing were a fairly blatant rip-off of Hagar the Horrible, if you remember him. That was I think it was in The Sun, probably. And I'd have been at that point probably maybe 11-ish, I guess. And it was also around the time that I first read The Lord of the Rings, which was a big kind of imaginative awakening, because it was like, oh my God, you know, people write stuff like this. I've been, up until that point, it was all kind of probably Enid Blyton adventure stories. And then it was like the lifting of the veil, and it was science fiction and fantasy. And I went in head first and stayed there for a long, long time. And that just fired up the urge to write stories. It was always about writing stories to begin with. And I've still got them up in my bookshelf here, stuff that I wrote when I was 12, 13, 14. Terrible, absolutely shocking derivative drivel. But the urge to do it was there. And along with that came maps because of the Tolkien thing and illustrations and all that sort of stuff. And that kind of bled into the little cartoons I was drawing, these little 4 or 5 panel cartoons. And that ultimately, I would say the kind of obsession with the Lord of the Rings at that time, which would have been early 70s, I guess, led to Conan the Barbarian and the fantasy things. And at that time, they were coming out with the Frank Frazetta covers on them, but it bore no relation to anything that was inside particularly. But those absolutely blew me away as a kid. It was like, oh my God, that is the most amazing thing I've ever seen. You know, the sort of the classic Death Dealer paintings and all that kind of stuff. And that all kind of led in that sort of fantasy direction for a long time. And ultimately, a big turning point was a mate of mine at school was an American comic book fan. And he poked, it was Neil Adams' Green Lantern, Green Arrow, under my nose, particularly the famous drug episodes, if you're familiar with them, from when Speedy gets a habit. And at that point, it was like everything kind of coalesced into one, it's comic books. I get it. I understand it. And that was sort of the beginning of a lifelong love affair, really. It's never stopped.
What with comics, when you find them, at whatever age you find them, they do leave an indelible mark on you. What is your indelible mark? What is the moment you can reach back and go, actually, this is the thing that sits in my head and informs everything that's happened since?
Well, the sort of that moment, it was at a party. I could take you to the house and point you to the room, you know, literally, where he pulled out this great pile of comics, pulled out, said, look at this, you know. And I'd never seen anything like it. I just thought it was so dynamic and so exciting. It was a real kind of watershed moment, there's a few sort of pinpoints along the way. And say reading The Lord of the Rings was a big awakening. The Conan books were sort of critical to, you know, as a 12, 13, 14 year old boy, it's like, yeah, this is literature, man. This is what I like, you know. And then that introduction to American comics in that way. I'd always been aware of them. And, you know, when we went on holiday, I was allowed to buy, because you used to find them at motorway service stations back in the sort of 70s. And I would buy, particularly the Hulk I was really into and stuff like that. But it never clicked in the same way. I needed a guru, effectively, to point me in the right direction, as it were. And this kid, you know, he put me into Green Lantern and introduced me to the X-Men. And I think around that time, I have to say my memory is notoriously fuzzy, so I do apologize if any of this is wildly inaccurate. But I seem to remember collections of John Byrne's X-Men, and stuff was going on, the Dark Phoenix saga stuff. That may have been later, I'm not entirely sure. I'd have to go back and check. But it's all in the mix, you know, as to what fired up the desire to write and draw comics. And I sat down, I can remember absolutely distinctly, remember trying to sit down to draw, in my mind, an American-style comic. And it turned out to be much harder than I thought it was going to be. Really, really hard. You know, it was all about anatomy and dynamism and all that stuff. But that became the challenge, and you know, a challenge with which I struggle to this day. one way or another. And then essentially, you know, this was going on when I was still sort of at school, I guess. And then I left school when I was 18 to go and got a job with the local council. And it was there, that would have been about 77, I guess. And it was shortly after that that 2000 AD appeared on the scene. And or in my life anyway, not the early issues. I think I came on, about 79, and the Dark Judges, I think, I guess, would be around that time. And like everybody else,
I was 81, I think.
No, I'm not sure.
Let me have a look.
Well, as I say, I'm notoriously fuzzy on that stuff. So. that would be about right, I guess, 81.
Yeah. Judge Death 149, 1980, beginning of 1980.
Okay. It's there or thereabouts. Yeah. There was a market stall on my way to work at the council house, and they had secondhand American books, but they also sold 2000. So I would always go in and root through piles and piles of American books. I got some fantastic rare bits and bobs out of those piles. They hated me, I think, because I just plundered all the good stuff, you know, and they didn't know what it was. Great. Happy days. And I wasn't really aware of British comics. As a kid, me and my brothers had Hotspur and Hornet and those kind of 60s comics with William Wilson was the one I always remember, the Mysterious Runner. Do you remember it? No. He used to wear like a black leotard. And,
right.
Yeah, weird story, really strange. And he used to run everywhere. That's all I can remember. So I wasn't particularly aware of British comics at all. And, you know, musically, I was very into the whole punk thing. Playing in bands again and all that kind of stuff. And that kind of ethos was in the air everywhere at the time. And 2000 AD just was like the proverbial breath of fresh air. I thought it was amazing. You know, the gateway drug of Brian Bolland is just so easy to digest. You know, it's like, oh my God, this is kind of graphically, it's just straight hardwired into, there's no work involved, you know, it just goes straight into your brain. The real turning point for many people was again Slane, when Mike McMahon was doing it or started doing it. And that required a bit more work. It wasn't so easily absorbed necessarily, but I think the rewards were probably, for somebody like me, were higher. You know, I recognized story and I recognized the place, and the style only ever went on to enhance the story and the place. You know, it's just, I loved it. I loved it.
I mean, it's interesting you mentioned punk there, because I was reading England's Dreaming, the John Savage account of the rise and fall of the Sex Pistols and punk. And one thing that really struck me was how punk in London, which is what everybody thinks of when they say punk, you know, all the Safety Pins and Mohicans and everything. Punk meant different things in different parts of the UK. So punk in Manchester was in many ways very different to punk in London, in that it was less about style and more about music. Whereas London, you know, style, Michael McLaren, Vivian Westwood, etc.
Yeah.
That was the big thing. I'm interested what punk meant to a kid near Burton-on-Trent.
Well, it's having said, my memory is absolutely terrible. Yeah. I can distinctly remember the day that there were a few proto bands in the school I was in. I was in the sixth form by this stage, I guess. And there was one of my bands would have been a little bit arty, you know, a little bit kind of a wee bit pretentious. And then another bunch of mates, they were doing like essentially covering classic, what was to become classic rock. At the time, it was just rock, is what it was. And we'd go and watch them rehearse in at lunchtime, you know, in one of their mum's houses. She was a very tolerant lady because it was loud. Man, it was loud. And not necessarily in tune. The day this kid who was the bass player, I think, in the band came in, he had New Rose by the Damned in one hand and Anarchy in the UK in the other hand, into the sixth form common room, stuck them both on. Up until then, it had been Wall to Wall, Tangerine Dream, Santana, you know, Yes, of course, which even then I couldn't digest. New Rose was just like my brain flipped. It was like, oh my God, that's the most exciting, powerful thing I've ever heard in my life. Followed shortly by Anarchy in the UK. But for me, it was New Rose because the dynamism of that song, even now, sounds intense to me. It's the punkiest of those original punk singles, to my ear at least. And it changed everything. You know, it just instantly, guitar was a different tool from what it had been. It was about, you know, up to that point, it was about virtuosity and technical and vanishing up your own fundament, essentially. And we were all doing it. We were all playing like that. And then all of a sudden it's an excuse. Well, hey, throw it all away. You know, we can just grind it out as loud as we like and as fast as we like. And it'll be exciting and fun. And that's pretty much what happened, you know. And Burton is almost the definition of a parochial town. I mean, it's the back end of nowhere. Its major saving grace is it had a great live music club, the 76 Club, a legendary club on the what was then the circuit of the kind of Aylesbury Friars was always the night before, and they'd turn up at the 76 Club, which was basically a glorified chip shop. But the people that played there, including the Sex Pistols, I might add, were amazing. So we did get that music. Nothing came from Manchester, but people came from London. So I saw all sorts of stuff, and it was just the most invigorating and exciting time I can remember. I was, whatever I was, 17 or 18, 76, yeah, I'd have been 18.
Right.
In preformed bands, and we just changed everything, changed the name, bought a mohair jumper or whatever, and went out and did it, you know. And it was brief, but it was glorious.
I'm interested in this, what this mix of things did, because, you know, you're a comic book reader, but it's primarily American comics. You're a fan of punk. 2000 AD comes along, which has that people, without going too far into it, people always talk about 2000 AD as being punk. Really, action was punk. 2000 AD had was more your kind of left wing, anti authoritarian satire. So I'm interested in how these things mixed into your brain and made you. You know what? I want to work in comics.
Yeah, I don't know. Is the short answer to that? I think, particularly as the 70s came to an end, and you know. The political scene shifted in the way it did. There was always quite the punk thing had quite a large, or certainly where we were, had quite a large political strand to it, in the anti-Nazi League and all that stuff that was going on, which was kind of enmeshed with the whole thing. So it seemed to me that 2000 AD was kind of a piece. I didn't make any distinction at the time. It was just like, this is what current culture is. You know, it's a comic where anything can happen in a world where any music can happen, you know. And I suppose, going back to something you mentioned earlier, is that there is an element of retreat in that comics and drawing strips and stuff, you have outside of, when you collaborate with people, but you have complete control. Bands, my bands certainly, were always fairly anarchic not in the musical sense, but just getting people to turn up was a challenge, you know, including myself, I might add. I mean, it was a pretty wild time. You know, I may look like a confused geography teacher, but I was a rock god, you know, and lived the lifestyle to a certain extent. And not really. Who am I kidding? But, you know, it was just all of a piece and everything was happening at a million miles an hour. And so the posters for the bands I would draw, and they'd be kind of comic book posters. Mm. Bizarrely, one of the ones still, my band from 1980-81, maybe late, we had a kind of 40th anniversary reunion. And one of the guys still had the posters, and I had forgotten, because of all people, it was influenced, the poster, although it had a kind of punk thing going on, it was influenced by Craig Russell, P. Craig Russell, I think, the American comic book artist, who's very kind of decorative and floral. God knows what I was thinking. What on earth was going on at that point, you know? But as I say, it was all of a piece at the time. I didn't really make a distinction between the art and the music. It was just, it all just came out, you know? It was a splurge of creativity. And
I mean, that's really interesting, because from my point of view, there has always been that slight decorativeness to your style, in that even when you're doing contemporary stuff, still little details in there, that feel not out of place, but speaking to an interest in fantasy and Lord of the Rings, you know, that they're harking back to that Conan.
Absolutely.
Most especially, you know, you we'll talk about them separately in a minute, but your Maeve the Many Armed that you did with Hilary Robinson for the Quantum Dog thing, the Elseworlds Judge Dredd, where he's a knight in shining armor. That always struck me as like, wow, this is what he wants to do, you know?
yes, yeah. No, there's no getting away from it. One of the other things, when I was late 70s, I mean, it was a very fertile and exciting time, was also to go back to illustrators, started with Arthur Rackham, probably, you know, sort of book illustration, which you can see that in modern comic book people. You know, lots of people have lifted from Rackham. And he led to I think, people like Edmund Dulac and John Bauer, the Swedish sort of fantasy illustrator who were all working around the turn of the 19th century. And that's in there as well. That's in the DNA, and I will slip it into anything wherever I get an opportunity, you know. And if there's an opportunity for a bit of knot work or the odd Celtic scroll or whatever, it's in. I just can't help it. I do it automatically. It's not a good habit in many ways, because I'm still drawing stuff now, and it's almost like automatic writing or something. And I'll do something. Oh, that's really good. That's great. And then I'll look at something I did 30 years ago, and it's the same. You know, it's like, have I progressed? Apparently not. You know, I'm still doing it. It's maybe slightly more confident, but it's still the same thing. It's just, there's no getting away from it.
Yeah, I mean, I find that absolutely fascinating, that you get artists to constantly change. You know, you're Mick McMahon's of this world, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Nothing but constantly innovate his style, and that's to do with, you know, I interviewed him a few years ago, not in any way, shape, or form to cast any aspersions, but it is an expression of his personality, of his psychology. You know, he's never happy with what he's done, so he's always looking to improve and do something different. But then you get other people who, again, their art is an expression of their personality, and it is so embedded in their personality that it can't change because I really get the sense, you know, talking about the music you're into, talking about the comics you were reading, that this was a style that was very early formed.
Mm.
And that's just the way you draw.
Yeah, no, I think it is. I am intensely critical of my own stuff. I don't like any of it, and I only see the faults, which is quite common for many artists, I think, as well. But I've given up fighting. You know, I realized quite a long time ago that no matter what I do, whatever I draw, it looks like I've drawn it, if you know what I mean. And I cannot escape that. So I just went on to embrace it and refine things and made them less ugly, worked on anatomy, all that stuff to try and get it flowing more. Some of the, you know, I'm jumping ahead slightly, but it was growing up in public. You know, my sort of formative years, if you like, were in public. You know, one of the first completed strips I ever drew for my own satisfaction did get published by Marvel and Marvel UK. And it's like, it's there warts and all, you know, and that was true of the early work in 2000 as well. But, you know, it was all part of a process. And I was quite driven, you know, at the time.
Was there a point where you thought this is what I want to do, or you know, coming to the age of 18, leaving school, was there any doubt in your mind that this is what you wanted to do, that you wanted to draw?
I had no expectation of doing it at all. I'd got what for the time was a pretty good job working for the local authority in Derby as a trainee environmental health officer. I was going to college on block release, which is great social life, you know, late 70s, early 80s, rocking time in Nottingham, I have to say. Again, lots of great music and it was a good time. I was being paid, which was great. So there was a great deal of comfort around that, if you like. It took quite a few years to probably the mid-80s for me to realise that I was, A, the worst environmental health officer the world has ever known. I was just absolutely not cut out for that sort of lifestyle, you know. I thought I was going to be some kind of eco-warrior, and it was crushingly bureaucratic. For somebody with a bit of creativity in them, it was just like a living death. Very, very good job, and plenty of my sort of colleagues and friends who are still colleagues and friends, stuck it out to the bitter end. But I hated it. And at the same time, I was drawing stuff and started to submit to editors. And it was really, I guess, bits and pieces were happening, as I say, that Marvel UK were publishing sort of amateur pieces, and I got some stuff there, which gave me confidence to submit things, I think. And it was once I started getting things for 2000 and the quantity of work started to build up, and you look at the finances and you think, well, hang on a minute, you know. At the time, I was working full-time during the day and drawing all night, literally all night. So those early Strontium Dog stories and Future Shocks and things, probably most of the first series of Gideon was done at night, having got home from working during the day. And it was then a point of, well, can I do this? I would love to do it. I would absolutely love to do it because it gives me great joy just putting pen to paper. Is it viable? Well, the only way to find out is do it. So I did.
The supreme confidence of youth.
I think, you know, it's still one of the pivotal sort of signpost moments in my life, was actually getting out from, you know, a soul destroying, really. I don't want to be dramatic about it, but it was crushing. And it was the catalyst to make that happen, you know? And it was great.
Tell us a little bit about Disenchantment, which was the fan art that got you into Marvel. I mean, this, correct me if I'm wrong, I possibly am. This sounds fantasy.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. It's, I will get it out of my system. I promise. We maybe have time to just mention stuff at the end, but yeah, no, it was, again, kind of, I think I've maybe read a Terry Pratchett book or something and thought, well, if he can do it, you know, he can do this kind of COD fantasy thing. So yes, it was essentially the story of an inept wizard, it's very Pratchett-y, who I kind of wrote and drew the first episode and left the end open in the hope, you know, that somebody might go, oh, why don't you do another one, you know? And it was a very, very feeble joke. So there's this wizard and his kind of warrior friend, and they inadvertently conjure up a demon and yada yada. Very, very lightweight. No plot, few jokes, but you know, it looked okay, I think. And they printed the whole thing. One of the most exciting moments of my life, you know, to see something you'd drawn in a magazine. I think that was in Mighty World of Marvel, I think it was, which I'd got into. Looking at it because it was following on, I imagine, although again, the timeline might be wrong, but Marvel had been doing the Daredevils, reprinting Frank Miller, his Daredevil run, but almost all of it was curated by Alan Moore, written by Alan Moore, or the articles were by Alan Moore. There was the Alan Moore Captain Britain thing, and it was like, this is just amazing. Had no idea who he was, of course, but that's what made me start picking up the sort of Marvel UK publications. And I thought, oh, yeah, I'll have a stab at this and sent the stuff in.
Because that morphed fairly quickly into Marvel's Secret Artist, didn't it? Tell us a little bit about that, because until I started researching you, I'd not actually seen that before.
Yeah, it was, my memory of it is not great, to be honest with you. It was like a one-page introduction to, there was another guy who came out of that kind of new talent showcase, as it were, who was doing these great caricatures of Marvel characters. Mm. And I think because it wasn't particularly Marvel-y, but they wanted to print them because they look so good. This was kind of a bridging story almost to suggest that this secret artist had been in at night and doctored various Marvel images. I remember particularly one of Thor, I think, and stuff like that, into these kind of crazy caricatures. So it's kind of set up the caricature picture, and I think that was poked fun of the editorial process themselves, I think, and I'm pretty sure it was John Tomlinson writing them. I think, as I say, it is a bit sketchy, but we did quite a few, or I did quite a few. It was only ever one page, and got paid. That was actually the first paid job I'd ever done. I was so excited because the checks came with like a Spider-Man and Hulk full color printed on the check. Yeah. And it was, yes, took that to the bank to cash it, you know. And can I have the check back, please? You know, once it's been cashed, because it looked great. I had it framed for a while, you know, because I am a sad, sad Jaffa. But yeah, that was, and then that just kind of fizzled out, I think. I don't really remember what happened after that. But those were the first professionally printed things, and yeah, it was good.
Could, obviously, John Tomlinson, who would go on to write Army of the Gideon. I mean, that was that the connection to 2000 AD, that when he went on to.
Yeah, that was. We were sort of reunited, I think,
right
at 2000, because I was always submitting samples to editors. So I submitted a sample to 2000 when Steve McManus was still in the chair, and he put it in front of Pat Mills, and Pat said, "Oh, yeah, you know, we can maybe try him out on something. Do some samples for a Nemesis story he had in mind," and the brief completely screwed it up, because the brief went for he was saying something along the lines of kind of the feeling of the Rocky Horror Show, and I took that maybe a bit too literally and came up with what was frankly a very camp version of Nemesis, and. It was a catastrophe, and Pat very nicely kind of said, "No, I don't think so. Yeah, I don't think so. Maybe something in the future, but not that version, my friend." You know, I was gutted. I mean, I was mortified because I thought that was my in. I thought I'm finally going to get to the Holy Land, because by that point, you know, getting into 2000 AD it wasn't an obsession, it was a goal, put it that way. You know, it was something that I would love to have achieved. So that was a knockback, but never one to give up. I did another kind of set of samples and submitted it. And then this time it came to Richard Burton. And he said yes to a Future Shock. And that Future Shock was written by John, who was then presumably freelancing for them, I would imagine. And John said, "Oh, it must be that Simon from, you know, the mighty world of Marvel days." So we were kind of I think it was John who wrote the first Future Shock that I did. Yeah.
You did a handful of them, including Writer's Block, which is. It's one of those stories which I just really enjoy. You probably have no memory of it whatsoever.
You're going to have to remind me. Sure, it was me.
Oh, no, it was definitely you. But it was written by Mike Collins.
Okay.
Then with it. Anyway, I won't go into that because you don't remember it. But I'm interested in where you were artistically at this point, because looking at those early Future Shocks, looking at the stuff you've done for Mighty World of Marvel, it's clear that you're learning, but again, that style is there. You know, it's recognisably you. Were you, I guess you've kind of already answered this, but were you happy with how things were going? Was this the pathway that you had envisaged?
You mean stylistically or?
Yeah.
No, never happy. To my mind, there are some of the artists who are great stylists. So Mike McMahon is clearly, you know, highly distinctive, even through his various incarnations. You can spot it instantly, you know. Mebius, or Mobius, depending on how you do it. I mean, these are the greats, as it were. But they have a distinctive style. So we have kind of covered this. I wanted to be a stylist. What in my mind was a stylist and come up with something, but no matter what I did, it always came out like I've drawn it, which is not what I was looking for. Now I realize, for better or worse, the way I draw is quite distinctive. So I've kind of got that whether I like it or not. And for most of the time drawing, I don't like it. You know, I'm extremely self-critical, and I only see the bad stuff, and there must be some good stuff in it because I've done so much, you know, but always trying to get to a point where I was happy. And I have got there a few times where I thought, I'm heading in the right direction here, but it's a battle for me, I have to say. It's a strange mixture of compulsion to do it, you know, and you're doing it, you think, oh, this is fantastic, this is great, this is amazing, you know. And I'll walk away from something and come back later and think one of two things usually, either A, oh, that's not bad, or oh my God, what was I thinking? And it's baffling. It's baffling to me, but I can't not do it. That's the trouble. I have no choice.
Yeah. Let's move on to talking about Maeve the Mini-Arm. Looking at Hilary Robinson's work for 2000 AD, you know, could have a big debate about what works and what doesn't. But Maeve is one of those characters that I thought, you know, at the time and in hindsight, really worked nicely. It's exactly the kind of story one would want to see from a Strontium Dog spin-off. What were your feelings at the time about it beyond, well, hey, I've got more work?
Well, of those Tales from the Doghouse strips, of which I did a few, I think, that was the one that caught my imagination. Because, you know, I'm into that whole Celtic fringe thing and, you know, that's not a very good term. Just the whole ethos and the visual tics of me and my sort of imagining of that kind of stuff. It was an opportunity. I thought it could have gone on to something else. And I think if you look at the drawing, you know, again, it's kind of, it's probably overworked, most of it, too laboured, really. I was terribly guilty of that. And that's through a lack of confidence in the lines. So I would bury them in a whole mass of other lines. But I think it showed through. I enjoyed that a lot. You know, I would have liked it to have been maybe a little bit more serious. You know, it was quite jokey, quite lightweight, but a great character and a great concept, you know. And controlling all those arms while you're drawing, quite a challenge to get it right. Yeah. Can't remember, she had four arms or eight arms, six, I can't remember.
Can't remember.
Quite a few.
It's one of those periods in 2080 where you're starting to, where you've really got the kind of second wave of creators who are coming along after many of the first generation had gone off to work in America. Mm-hmm. Were you conscious of being part of a generation of artists, or was it an isolated experience?
It was the latter. One of the big drawbacks, I think, was particularly once I took the plunge and went full time. We were communicating by letter, for God's sake. You know, we didn't even have fax machines. So I would wait by the post for a script to come through, and I'd write out a reply with some notes, send it back, you know, and then wait another week and it would come through the post. Nobody phoned anybody. There was no communication, and it's hard to imagine now the extent to which you feel quite isolated. I felt quite isolated. I was loving it all and enjoying it. And when we had the opportunity to go to the relatively rare Comic Cons or gatherings, that was fantastic because you met other people. Oh, you're you. You do that. Oh, yeah, okay. Outside of that, I had no sense of community, no feedback, nothing. I had no idea whether a strip was well received or was hated. I was just sitting in my little garret, kind of plodding away and sending it off. You know, it was a slightly odd experience in that respect. And for a pretty gregarious person, not necessarily a great way of life. Mm. Don't want to sound negative here, but it was quite isolated. Mm. And being stuck up in the Midlands didn't help, I think, to be honest with you.
Well, you often get groups of creators in roughly the same geographical area. You know, I'm thinking the Totnes Mafia of Jock and Dom Reardon and Lee Garbutt and the Welsh Mafia of Mike Collins and Dylan Teague and whatnot down there. But it is interesting that kind of dislocation because of lack of physical location, because you talk to talk to Kevin Hill, and he reminisced about going to the pub on a Friday when everybody had brought their artwork down.
Yeah.
But I guess, for you, that would have been a hell of a jaunt.
Yes.
And
yeah.
An expense as well that you might not necessarily be able to afford.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It was, and it never occurred to me that anybody might do that. Mm. You see, there wasn't a sense of community in the way that I feel there could be now, because there wasn't the communication. So the hub of communication was the office or the editorial team, and they were busy people. They had their own issues. They weren't there to nursemaid me through my long and lonely nights, So, it was odd, didn't really have much interaction with anybody. It was that aspect of it was quite strange. I think it would be very, very different now. You have the joys of Zoom and phones and instant communication globally. It was just an entirely different world in that respect. Strange.
Were you looking at any other outlets, or were you still very much focused on 2000 AD?
To begin with, it was all 2000 AD. But I thought, well, if this is going to work, I need to broaden my horizons, as it were. And I was submitting stuff all over the place, but alas, to no avail. America, all that sort of stuff.
And I mean, I guess we should talk about Armageddon now, because that's the series that I remember your work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And looking at the digital collection, the first digital collection that we just bought out, what's really striking is how quickly your confidence grows in mm-hmm. what you're doing over the course of those stories. I wanted to get an idea of whether you had a sense of that. But I guess, first of all, let's talk about the origins of it. Was this something you just kind of, came in the post and said, this is a new strip that you need to do?
Almost, not quite. I think my recollection of it is that I've been doing the Future Shocks and the Doghouse stuff, I think. Richard in particular wanted maybe to get an ongoing story for me, a proper 2000 AD story. And I think at that point, maybe the old connection that I had with John through the mighty world of Marvel kind of reared its head, and he foolishly put his hand up to do something. And I think I seem to remember at the time there was an idea for a character along the lines, there was an indie comic at the time called Concrete. I don't know if you're familiar with it, which was this kind of golem-like looking creature. And the idea was to do something big and lumbering. Obviously, this was in a post-ABC Bisley era. Doing something unearthly cool like that was not a possibility for me. So it had to be different. I had more an idea in my mind of, if they made the movie of Armageddon, it would be like those 60s Godzilla movies. It would be a guy in a suit lumbering about in a very poor set. That was what I had in my head.
Yeah.
This kind of crazy, oversized box of not very convincing robotry. Robotry, that's not a word, is it? John went with it, and the idea was this kind of exorcist robot who had multiple panels. We kind of dropped that later, but they were supposed to be like holy water and wooden stakes for the vampires, and the speakers on him were supposed to play blessings, It's crazy. So that was how the concept emerged. I did a couple of passes at a design. So we worked up a design, but fundamentally the Gideon that came out in the end was pretty much the initial design. Changed his head slightly, made it a bit bigger. And then the first script followed, dropped on the doorstep and I started. First episode I drew was rejected. I can't really remember why. I think it may have just been, certainly the first page, looking back, you think, oh gosh, you know, it's not really got the impact that people were looking for. If you remember, he's busting through a wall, which was a bit of a blow. But then went back and it actually had the effect of galvanizing me into some kind of action, I think, and focused in a way. I don't know whether it was like nerves at starting a big story that I kind of just foobarred it a little bit, but that knockback actually helped, I think, and made me focus and see a way forward, I think, with a particular style. I would say, again, I think it was overworked, and the printing at the time wasn't really up to that level of fine line, shall we say. So, in fact, it's not just the printing. I think the photography wasn't necessarily up to it, because with the greatest respect to the digital edition, I can see, you know, the limitations of the actual original photographs. So that was a learning curve, you know, because then try and rein it in to make it fit the process more, instead of just absolutely doing what I wanted to do. I was trying to tweak it more to the actual printing process to make it more viable, really.
I love this interplay between what artists are producing and what they're seeing in the finished comic, because I had Dermot Power on last year, and I think it was him. He said that's exactly what happened to him. He started doing it for 2000 AD and looked at it and went, oh my God, it's so muddy. And yes. So he just upped the contrast on all of his paint.
Yeah.
So it became this incredibly vivid, almost kind of blocks of bright, bright color. Mm. And I think I'm getting this right, for him, that just went too far the other way. You know, he wasn't painting the way he wanted to because the technology just wasn't capable of keeping up.
Whereas I had a not dissimilar experience at the other end of the spectrum, again, jumping forward slightly, and not, you know, it's not the same as it would have been for Dermot, but one of the things when we flipped colour, I think it probably started coming in much more completely in 2000, in sort of 1991 or something like that. One of the things Richard said at the time is, you've got to remember, make it bright, because it won't translate. And between the first series of Gideon and the second series of Gideon, I think Dead Meat came in. And as an experiment, I was using like Day-Glo poster paints, because I thought, this will make it bright. I'll give them bright. And it was like way, way over the top. It's just, oh my God. And it's another one of those, what was I thinking? But you don't know until you see it in print. It's like,
you know. I see, again, there's a slightly alienating effect that you don't necessarily get today, because, you know, you printing is so much, it's not perfect, but it's so much better now than it was. Mm. Because you're using computers rather than photography.
Of course, yeah.
But back then, you know, until that stuff saw print, you're in the dark.
Mm. No, totally. You know, it's a different process and a different world. But I mean, it's positively primitive than what used to go on. I mean, when I started, I was drawing on these this really nice art board. I'd spent a fortune on board. I loved it. I love paper to this day, pens and paper and board. And the artwork would come back having been ripped off. It just ripped off the top sheet so they could get it onto the drum, you know. And it's like, oh my God, that cost me 10 quid, that piece of paper, you know. And that was in like 19 whatever. And it was different, and it was a struggle for for somebody like me who tries to hide behind lines as well, too many lines. And, that was a pretty steep learning curve as well.
I mean, it's interesting that you mentioned Bisley's work on ABC Warriors there, because so much of that, one of the interesting things about the Black Hole was the contrast between his and Smuzz's work, which was much more sci-fi, you know, much more traditional cross-hatching. Whereas Bisley's work combined fine lines with spot blacks, you know, heavy shadows, lots of black everywhere. And for me, that is interesting in the context of what you're saying about Armageddon, in that, you know, your style used cross-hatching a lot, you know.
Yes.
It was a fundamental part. But at the same time, you know, you're seeing that those two contrasting styles. You see what I'm getting at there?
Totally, yeah. No, that came out of, that was the way I was heading anyway. You know, if you look back at Disenchantment, and reminds me, I need to sue Netflix for nicking my idea, I have to say, with their series Disenchantment.
Yeah.
It was heading in that direction anyway, so it wasn't, you know, following on from you know, Bisley's impact in 2000 AD is widely recorded. I mean, it's just amazing achievement at the time. It just blew everything out of the water. So I wasn't consciously keeping away from it, I don't think, but that was the direction I was going anyway. And I think it was just in many ways one of many kind of blind alleys that I explored way beyond the need to explore a blind alley, if you know what I mean. But, you know, it kind of stands up. It's interesting that even after all this time, again, there was zero feedback about how well it was received. And subsequently, turns out it was quite popular. Popular or not, people remember it, even now. You know, I mean, it's whatever it is, 25, 30 years on. Mm. People still remember it, which is remarkable.
You mentioned the switch to colour,
mm-hmm.
which for me is really when your art comes alive in a way that perhaps it hadn't necessarily done before. But it looked on the page like an intensive process. There's a lot of airbrush going on.
Mm-hmm. In there. There was, yeah. I got very good at it. I say very good, I got very quick. So I had the technique down. I guess, you know, if you're working to a deadline, that is the same thing, trust me. But part of the frustration and why the black and white stuff was so heavily labored, I think, in some respects, you know, the core of the drawing, I think, was okay, but I would be guilty of overworking it. And, you know, not always, but some of the time. And I think that was because in my mind the image was in colour, and it was textured and it had contour and all that sort of stuff. So that single line cartooning thing, I didn't have the confidence to do it. So I wanted an image that conveyed what a colour image would do in black and white. Turns out that's not that easy. The step to colour was like, thank you very much, that'll do, I'm away, you know, I can do this. It became much more enjoyable, actually, as a process, even though it was relatively labour-intensive, but drawing all those lines was also quite labour-intensive. There was scope for experimentation again. It's amazing how tolerant, actually, the editorial team were. It was either tolerance or they were pushed by deadlines, one of the two, and couldn't keep sending stuff back because I was flip-flopping on technique all the time. The airbrushing was pretty consistent, but the sort of paint I was using and how I was applying them and trying to do different things, there's a lot of experimentation. I can see you know, where I'm going through phases where I'm thinking, oh, I'm going to do this or I'm going to do that. And to varying degrees of success, you know, the whole of the last, I think the last series of Dead Meat was a complete experiment. God knows what I was thinking, you know, I have no idea. But on Gideon, it was the series two was like a coming together of all my favorite things. You know, there was kind of arcane magic. And I think it was in that one that John introduced some of my characters from the old Disenchantment strip. So the warrior and the wizard, they came into that. I think that was series two. monsters, you know, demons. Thank you very much. That'll do nicely. Mm-hmm.
There's always something, and please don't take this the wrong way, there's always something inherently cartoonish about your style. So that even in its violence and its action, there is something of the slapstick. Where does that come from?
I think that's my personality, writ large, you know. I'm a goof, you know, really. Kind of, it's hard to take anything seriously. And I'm not sure I could do a serious horror story. I could try, but I just there is that kid drawing the Hagar the Horrible ripoff is still in me, you know, fighting to get out. So inevitably, and that's why, you know, I was drawn to Terry Pratchett very early on and stuff, because he has that same sensibility of just lampooning things. And no, I just can't do it. I would like to be deeply, I'd love to do like a really heavy, violent noir comic, you know, kind of a 40s milieu or something. And but it's just, that still sticks something stupid in it. I know I would. I can't, it's just in me. I can't do anything about it. And I stop fighting, you know, just embrace it and go with the goof. I may have a T-shirt made of that. Start a new campaign and go with the goof.
But I mean, there's a wonderful moments in Armageddon where you're doing the kind of, I guess you'd describe it as body horror these days. You know, there's lots of nasty things coming out of sewers. And
I was quite good at that.
There's... Within them, they for me, there's almost a kind of Hogarthian grotesque about them, which is that mix of funny and horrid.
Yeah.
At the same time, you know, and that's something that I mean, you know what? That's really interesting, because you know you didn't really do British comics, but for me that's something intrinsically British. You know, you look at Ken Reed, you look at Leo Baxendale, the kind of things that you know they would do it, and that's that combination of horrible and funny. I mean, Faceache, for example, is a perfect example. So it's interesting that your tastes rest in American comics. There's something very, very British about the way that you do comics, you know?
Unquestionably. And I think that may have contributed to my singular lack of ability to get anything outside of the UK. Just it's too much of an oddball sensibility, really, I suppose. A kind of, I don't know whether it's a British sense of humour or it's just in our genes, or in my genes in particular. You know, it's just, it's in there. And I stopped fighting it a long time ago. You know, I know I can get as far as queasy, I think. There was, you may remember there's one where the food is possessed and the guy's tongue becomes kind of possessed and comes out and it's all eyes and, yeah, it's horrible. That made quite a few people I know quite... feel quite uncomfortable, and I was delighted. So that's the most successful I've ever been, actually disturbing someone, you know. Still my proudest moment. But even then, you know, it's in a goofball story about a kind of MasterChef scenario. You know, John was kind of ahead of his time on that one. It's lampooning that whole food culture thing and possessed food. You know, we had possessed food. We had possessed washing up in Nanette. The references for which most people these days will not understand, you know, as in who the hell is Nanette, you know. Do you know who Nanette is?
No.
No, no, because it's in the digital thing. She was Nanette Newman, who was the wife of Brian Forbes, the film director. But she made advertisements for fairy washing up liquid. Right. And hence the title No No Nanette, which is also a reference to a play or a musical. And the, you know, the tagline for the advert was mild green fairy liquid. Was this is what she was promoting. So in the story it transmogrifies into vile green hairy liquid, which, you know, it's just such a corny joke, but it made me laugh the day I read it, you know. So it was hard for it not to be essentially a comedy strip, really, with a couple of moments of kind of pathos, I suppose.
I want to talk about Dead Meat, because I'm just going to come out and say I loved Dead Meat.
Good for you.
I know that I'm not necessarily in anything approaching a majority there. I think it's as much to do with when it appeared as to what it was, because around about the same time you had we'd had Crisis, and that had gone the way of all flesh. With, you know, as great as it was, there was an earnestness about it, a very particular earnestness which things like Toxic kind of push back against.
Yes.
But in 2000 AD, you know, you had Dead Meat, you had Trash, which was another environmental story. And I always felt it was one of those strips that was good, but the era in which it appeared counted against it. You know, it was lumped in with lots of other stuff. And I'm trying to remember who, Michael Cook.
Michael Cook, the
writer on that. I'm very interested in the genesis of this, because for me it's a very straightforward 2000 AD idea, you know, talking about in a vegetarian future.
Ahead of his time in many ways. I mean, you know, if you look at it in the context of, you know, enforced vegetarianism, which is essentially what it is, you know, it's like, as a satire on the current kind of food cultures and things, it would work very, very well. Got to say, that, I think it dropped on my map between, it was like a dream. It was just fantastic. Between the end of the first series of Gideon, this was the point at which I went full time. I took the plunge in 1990. April the 1st, 1990, in fact, funnily enough. Which was seared into my memory, that one is. And at that point, I was hassling John to get on to, because he said, oh, we're going to do the next series of Armageddon in colour, now in colour. And I thought, oh, great, this is fantastic. Boy, was he slow getting that one out. That took a long time coming. And in the interim, this thing dropped in from Michael, which Richard had really, really dug. He thought it was excellent. And it was pretty much fully formed. I got a whole ream of stuff. And I think, I'm pretty sure we met up, because I think he may have lived Nottingham Derby way or something. I can't remember, Michael. And we met up and talked through it and sort of bandied some ideas around. But as it appears, the concept and the content is 100% Michael. I thought it was great. You know, I thought it was maybe a little bit earnest, maybe a bit too cute. And I did my hardest to make a giant man sheep look cool, and that's a task, I can tell you. I'm sure better men than me could make it work, but you know. So in the end, it became what it was. You know, it was an experiment in the art process. So I was trying to drop lines out of it altogether, and just wasn't painting as such. More like kind of an elaborate color by numbers without any lines. So there was no grading. If you look at it, if you can be bothered to look at it, it's all block covers, but sort of matched next to each other so that it gives the impression of depth or shading or something, but it isn't, or not intentionally anyway. And Michael, I think he nailed something there, but it was the wrong time. Simple as that, I think. Yeah. I think we did two series of it, and you know, it was. You see, funnily enough, that's when I did get feedback on. unfortunately, and it just wasn't popular, you know. And I think the same happened with Nigel on Trash. I think, you know, maybe too earnest and just not wham bam thank you ma'am enough for the time.
I think it's the great difficulty of satire, particularly in comics, is that, you know, you try and put your finger on the pulse, and you can, if it's too obvious, people can react negatively. There has to be a certain subtlety to it, but that is insanely difficult. You know, we can look back at the Burger Barons of the Cursed Earth and go, oh, absolutely, that was, you know, fantastic satire. But that was just one idea of a million that you know, Pat and Chris Lauder and John poured into Cursed Earth, and it could so easily have not worked. So I always felt it was a shame with Dead Meat, because I just really like the idea of a talking sheep. And B of clothes being so rare that Vera Brett is still walking around in her
school. Wearing her school uniform. Yeah, it's a great idea. You know, it's a great idea. I think my execution was poor of some aspects of it, and bits of it I'm quite happy with, but I haven't seen it for a long, long time. You know, I've got bits and bobs of stuff lying around, but not much. So, you know, I enjoyed doing it, put it that way, and would like to have had more time, and in retrospect would do many things very differently. But that's, I'm sure everybody says that, you know, if you could have your time again, you would, you know, maybe go back and iron out some of those aspects that at the time were either expedient or seemed like a good idea, you know. I think certainly there's quite a lot of weakness in some of the drawing, and some of it was probably okay. I don't know. I'm not sure. Some good airbrushing in it. Remember that. That was definitely a moment for the airbrush, for sure.
Because there was a couple of Dread stories in there, both of which have what we've already talked about, those kind of slightly mythic qualities, you know, the framing of them, particularly the one for the special, whose name I've completely
forgotten. Medieval Dread. It was the Winter Alternity Special, or something.
Yes, yeah, that's right. Yeah. Medieval Dread. And that for me is archetypal. You know, it's got all the elements of exactly what you'd expect in there.
Yes. I mean, not least because I wrote it. Well, and yes, which is a sure sign. But yeah, I mean, it was, I don't know what it was, 6 or 8 pages. I can't remember. But John was in the Tharg chair by this stage and was filling this up. And he said to me, you know, the old stories that I'd done, he said, they were good. You should try and write something. So he got me to like pitch. I think I did two or three or four kind of outlines for stories. And I remember, I think it was in the letter to him, letter again, you know, here's my pitches. And if none of these like float your boat, I just said, how about the medieval dread? And that was it, you know. And he came back and said, well, that's okay. But I really like the idea of the medieval dread. So I then went and wrote it. And I mean, it's the flimsiest of plots, designed entirely for me to do the stuff I like to do, which is kind of cod medieval. But it seemed such a no-brainer to do a cod medieval Judge Dredd. I just think, you know, he's born to live in that world. He's almost a throwback or throw forward from that world. Mm. And the transition to Anderson being a witch and, you know, all that stuff was just so easy. I couldn't believe anybody hadn't done it before, to be honest with you, and would merit a much longer revisitation, I would say, by somebody.
But by this point, where were you in terms of your career, how you viewed things? Because obviously, you know, colleague, your fellow contributor was now in the chair at 2008. Were you thinking, oh, you know, this is going to result in a lot more work, or did you have eyes elsewhere?
Well, this would be kind of, I guess, 95, 96 is something like that. I think at that point, It was good, but I think I felt like I wasn't really going anywhere with this. I thought I can't rely on 2008. Efforts to get work outside had failed. You know, I hadn't tried that hard, to be honest with you, but we'd done four series of Armageddon. The last one, you know, I think the art was probably quite good. And then there was sort of a bit of Judge Dredd and some Robo Hunter, I think. There was some Pete Hogan stuff and stuff with Mark Miller, as I recall. Quite a few of those, I think, maybe two or three. Can't remember. Sort of two or three parters. It is a bit fuzzy.
There was some yearbook sci-fi special.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, I think that was Mark as well, wasn't it?
Yeah,
I can't remember. I'd need to go back and search the internet, you know, or something. But at the same time, I, you know, by this time it was 6 years full time, and for a lot of it, you know, I'd been living on my own. And my daily routine was like, get up, go to the drawing board, which was literally 10 feet away, you know, work for a very long time. Sometimes I wasn't great at deadlines. So sometimes hitting a deadline, I always hit the deadline, but I didn't always give myself enough time. So I would put in very, very long shifts and then go back to bed. You know, I literally spoke to no one. And I'm thinking, oh God, you know, I can't really, I'm not sure I can sustain this. And at the same time, I was playing in a couple of bands around the Midlands, just pub gigs and sort of small clubs and things. And that part of my life, the other major sort of obsession in life, apart from comics and drawing and art, you know, popular art, pop culture art, was guitars. I'd always been really into guitar since I was a kid, played in bands since I was 16. And I started working just to sort of socialise in a big guitar shop in Birmingham. I sort of went in there with the drummer of my band at the time and sort of said, oh, you know, it'd be quite cool. And that actually just kind of took over. And there was an editorial change at 2000. John left, I think, to go maybe to Eagle Moss or something. I'm not quite sure. And the stuff that was coming in, I was kind of getting more kind of colouring jobs and things, which I wasn't really enjoying, you know, and it was a change in direction. So at the same time, I was doing some freelancing on children's books and stuff like that, and some educational books, and for an agent. But you know, again, it's not robots and monsters, is it? You know, it's if it's not robots and monsters, I'm not interested. So it just kind of fizzled out, and there came a point where I stopped making the call to the office to say, look, you got anything going? The office stopped calling me. I stopped submitting and just threw myself into this other world of guitars. And that's where I've been ever since, pretty much.
So, I mean, that's a very interesting step to have taken.
Mm.
I guess the most obvious question is, how did that work out?
Well, it worked out very well. You know, I ended up going places and meeting people that I would never dreamed of doing. I work for I don't think it's a secret, I work for Fender Guitars, a big American company, and sort of work in the sales side over here in Europe. And it's amazing. It's a whole other universe of creators and creativity and music, musicians, and you know, I mean, there's a lot of mundanity to it, but it, as I say, it's taken me kind of places I would never have dreamt of going, all across the Western Hemisphere, you know. And I've never stopped drawing, and I still create comic books and comic strips. I've got a huge archive, and I've had a go at setting up collaborations online with people, which have invariably failed. Not by me, I might add, but you know, people, when there's no specific goal or specific target, or it's a kind of professional operation, it's very easy for people just to abandon projects and walk away from them. And that's something I will not get involved with again, because I've been burnt a couple of times in recent years on what would have been creator-owned projects, I guess. But now I'm doing stuff over which I have, you know, complete control. Mm. And that suits me just fine and dandy. And, you know, it's still there. The urge to create is still there, and the creation is still going on. I'm still producing stuff all the time. It may see the light of day one day. It may not. I don't know. But it definitely ticks the boxes. And in the meantime, the day job, as it were. In fact, I'm almost back to where I started, sort of spending large times in the evening, less time available these days. But working, and it's all. What you can't see is I'm sitting in front of the deck of the Enterprise here. It's like I am teched up to the eyeballs, yeah. And you know, I've got a mass array of monitors and computers for creating comics, and I guess you'd say that is my hobby. And you know, the shift away from freelancing, which is, you know, it's a tough gig if you're not mentally inclined that way. I think you need a certain sort of resilience, self-confidence, fortitude. You know, it can be a difficult life. And ultimately, back then, at that point, it wasn't working for me. And you know, it wasn't a conscious decision. It just kind of happened. One thing just took over, an opportunity came my way, and I took it, and it led me in a different direction. Yeah. I do wonder a lot about the what ifs.
Mm.
You know, what would have happened if I'd stuck at it, and, you know, maybe been a bit more diligent and a bit more applied myself a little bit more, but who knows?
I mean, there's a couple of things there. It's fascinating that it happened then, because that's the period when actually you begin to see so many artists pivot away from comics or you know, effectively get day jobs, and comics is just something they also do. You know, I'm thinking about the number of people who have gone into film and TV and advertising. You know, I had a long chat with Anthony Williams last year, and that's basically the route he went into. You know, he started getting illustration work that paid a lot better. But also is it something that, because a lot of people, I guess, would think of the two arenas as being separate, as not being, you know, part of the same milieu. But the art, just as the style is so that you developed, is so intrinsic to your art. Mm-hmm. Is that your time in comics intrinsic to who you are, what you're doing now?
Absolutely, yeah. You know, it's always in there, and I'm completely delighted to have done it. You know, 2000 AD is an amazing institution, really, in all its many incarnations, and there've been quite a few, effectively. You know, and to have a little corner of that, little piece of that history. Which is forever Jacob, you know, suits me fine and dandy. You know, I have nothing but positive memories of the experience. The only caveat being I would like to have been better and had more time and more focus. And, you know, if we all had our time over again, we would do some things differently, I guess. And that's one of them. But, you know, here we are 25, 30 years on, still talking about a pretty obscure comic strip. And that's great. You know, I'm delighted to have done it. And I'm pretty proud of it, really. You know, it's survived by one means or another in the memory of a certain tier of men between the age of... probably 25 and 60, I would say, British men. Yeah. So, you know,
It's, I mean, it's that interesting thing about how when you think about comics and what people consider the comics industry, you know, they may think of 2000 AD, they'll think of Marvel and DC, they might think of manga. But there's the fact that this small corner of comics is somewhere that creators can spend their entire career,
absolutely,
and never step outside of that. Which I think speaks to not just how you know loyal and dedicated that readership is, but also how 2000 AD, to an extent, even though it takes an awful lot of work to keep it going, is a self-sustaining idea. You know, it can have Armageddon, it can have Dead Meat, it can have, you know, spin-offs of Strontium Dog, while so much else is going on, because, you know, that's the nature of that anthology format. It just chews through content.
Yeah, no, it's that key word, isn't it? It's anthology that you know, has allowed. There's something very particular, a very particular skill, particularly in the storytelling, of honing it into this tiny little slice of dialogue or imagery, you know. And it clearly attracts a certain type of mind. And when you look at the people who have come out of 2000 AD or have passed through 2000 AD in terms of creatives I'm talking about, you know, there are some sublime creatives have been touched by it, and something to do with that format, and that it's kind of unique. I don't know that format exists anywhere else, the anthology comic, to the same extent. And I mean, it's been said many times, but if you can write an original good Future Shock, you're probably a genius, because A, they've all been written, and B, coming up with something that concise and that focused that has a plot of some sort. It has to have some kind of plot and a denouement. That's a real talent, you know, and it's a great proving ground for that, and still is, you know.
With the stuff that you put up online, I think it's fascinating the way that working on a computer has made your stuff literally slicker.
Like it, yes, it,
mm-hmm. it is so much clearer, but the essence is still there. You know, it's still a Simon Jacob piece. Mm. And I guess from your point of view, you can do what you want now because it's the pressure isn't there to create. You can literally do what you want, you know?
No, absolutely. And I mean, if you've looked at anything online, it's all part of, you know, I'm creating my own story because I'm into this kind of sub-creation thing that going way back to the beginning that Tolkien used to talk about, this idea of sub-creation and world creation and stuff. And there is no doubt that answering only to myself is liberating. Mm. It can be a problem because you then run the risk of self-indulgence, of course. But the combination of that and technology has been a real revelation to me over the last 5-10 years. You know, everything has changed because of technology, and it's been the most liberating experience. So the way I work now, I still draw and then scan, and what I'm doing is many, many fewer lines. Although the artwork is still fairly complex, most of that is computer color, and boy, is that a lot quicker than airbrushing. I can tell you that. You know, I used to spend hours masking off with masking tape and tracing paper like this. It's a button on my computer now, you know, and it's like, bink, mask, thank you very much, spray, done. You know, and it delivers a look that was always in my mind of how I wanted it to look. Mm. But now it's so easy. It's so easy. You know, and I spend way too much time colouring stuff. I'm gonna complete my current project, and the next thing I do is gonna be, you know, half tone, you know, one or two colours blocked. That's it. No. But it's a different world. We're living in a different world. I can communicate with people. I can share my art with people. I can share projects with people, most of which have been catastrophes, unfortunately. That's not fair, but they failed, you know. I came, a very, very brief anecdote, because I'm sure we're running out of time. At the end of a project that was looking pretty good, and it was spread across all of North America. We had a letterer, colorist, writer on board, and of all people, it was the colorist that dropped out. You know, and the whole thing came about like a house of cards. And at the same time, I was regularly listening to a program on Radio 3 in the morning when they'd have some kind of actor or person in the arts do a kind of small interview and choose a couple of his music. And they had John Lithgow on. And he was droning on about how lucky he'd been to have worked constantly all his life. He said, "And what do you do to relax?" And so I get involved in sort of art projects. He said, "But I don't allow anybody else to become involved because I will only ever be disappointed." And I thought, fuck me, John, you're right. I am going to adopt the mantra of John Lithgow, and I'm going to do everything myself. And because it's a hobby and there's no deadline and there's no editor, that's where I'm at, and I'm having a ball.
Excellent. If people want to find you online to come and tell you how much they love Dead Meat, where can they find you?
Probably the best place is DeviantArt website. I've got loads of art up on there now. And if you just go to DeviantArt and search for Simon Jacob, I am there. I'm also on Facebook, Instagram. You know, I'm not a private person on social media. So, you know, I am pretty much a media whore. So if you want to get in touch, I'm there to be gotten in touch with. Oh, and on Twitter as well, of course. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much to Simon for what was an absolutely enthralling chat about his career, not just at 2080, but beyond, and what he's been up to in the last few years. So, I hope you enjoyed that, Earthlitz. The Armored Gideon collection, which is one of our digital-only collections available from our web shop and apps, is out now. I very much encourage you to get that because, number one, you can see what we've been talking about, and number two, you get to enjoy Armored Gideon in its unexpurgated form. So, do head along, like I said, to the web shop or the app to purchase that. Plenty more digital-only collections coming this year just to kind of, you know, try and get things back into some kind of print, albeit digital, which have long been unavailable. Revere, we've got Flesh, Midnight Cowboy, Mean Arena, which is the latest one, which is a fantastic piece of classic 2000 AD. So, enjoy those. We're going to be back in 7 days' time with more from the Galaxy's Greatest podcast. We've got some nice interviews lined up, as well as dives into the things that we've been percolating away at 2000 AD over the last few months. So, I'll see you right back here, Earthlitz. Don't touch that dial. Take care of yourselves. Take care of all those around you. And Splendig Verthrig.
Fell power levels dangerously high. Alert! Alert! Read 2000 AD every week. Ask your comic book store or newsagent now. Subscribe to the Galaxy's Greatest Comic at 2000adonline.com.